It's always a very special privilege again to introduce somebody who is not only an internationally acclaimed and renowned academic, a leader in their field of specialty, but also a dignified administrator in the education of medicine. Apart from all of that, and I joked with one of my other colleagues yesterday, he's a friend of mine, although he may not want you to know that, purely because that may not be a recommendation for him. But not only is he a friend, he's also had his hand in my own health. Dr. Albert Rees comes to us from Maryland, United States. Not originally, he can tell you where he's from if you don't detect that as he speaks. He's the dean of the medical school of the University of Maryland, the vice president for medical affairs of that prestigious school. He's also currently the chairman of the Council of Deans of the United States. He, apart from that, is a specialized registered obstetrician and gynecologist, has a very special interest in diabetes and also in stem cells. So he brings to us a diversity of interest, of qualification, and amidst all of that, a benchmark of humility. And today he's going to speak to us about today's lifestyle, tomorrow's epidemic. Al, it's a huge privilege to welcome you to be with us today and to thank you for coming to speak on the topic.
Dr. Landless, Dr. Handysides, ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege for me to be here. This symposium seems to be, I didn't have a chance to be here for the whole yesterday and the day before, but in looking over the brochure, I clearly see that there are lots of exciting lectures that you had, and in chatting with folks, it seems as if this has been a really exciting time. I had an opportunity to be a part of one of the interactive seminars yesterday, and we had a nice exchange with a number of people. Now, before I go further, I'm told that there are simultaneous translations, and I'm encouraged to speak slowly. So if I speed up accidentally, I've asked the folks in the back just to wave at me, and I will slow down. So if I don't see a hand, I'm going to assume that my pace is just right. Okay? All right. I got those hands. Well, Peter, again, it's a privilege to be here. What I want to talk to you about is, as listed on the slide, but I want to share with you a series of areas, the definition of what I'm talking about, the cause and the consequences, focus on some of the key areas of lifestyle-induced diseases, and also some of the perils that we face, as well as a model for prevention and intervention. The model I will share with you is an Adventist model, but I'll also share with you scientific data that provides credence for the model, both by the Adventist as well as by others as well. Let's talk about what are lifestyle diseases. And you can see, again, these are diseases that in which are caused by an inappropriate relationship of people with their environment. And you can see it takes years to develop. And once these lifestyle diseases are developed, it is not easily treated or cured. So therefore, the period of development is essential in trying to intervene. These are also diseases that become widespread as countries become more industrialized. And as I try to depict using some graphics what I'm talking about, because they may in fact convey to you more information than sometimes the words themselves. You can see that these are all potentially preventable by changes in our diet, in our exercise habits, as well as our interaction or relationship with the environment. Now, in the early 1900s, you can see the major cause of death, and we know this, the major cause of death in the early 1900s was primarily infection, malnutrition. Those were primary cause of death. There were communicable diseases accounted for two-thirds of all deaths worldwide. Just listing the top 10 list of diseases that caused death at the time, you can sort of foresee what they are. But I hope you notice what are the types of disease that are absent then that are present now. So focus on those diseases for a moment. We're going to switch to fast forward to today. A similar percentage is actually accounted for by lifestyle diseases. So we've actually made progress. We have switched from dying from one group of diseases to dying from another group of diseases, except one we contract, sometimes accidentally, and one we induce, either purposefully or certainly permissively. So you can see clearly that the top 10 causes of diseases now are many of which are from our own making. Heart disease, stroke, lung cancer, and you can see chronic infections of various types, cancers, dementia, diabetes, cancer again. Well, in the interest of time, I'm going to focus on a few areas. Making the point? Cardiovascular disease, lung disease, cancer, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. In the interest of time, I'll select two of the rising diseases or habits, obesity and type 2 diabetes. But many of what I'm going to say could be applied to others as well. We don't have time for me to go through each of these lifestyle-induced diseases. But let's take obesity. Let's focus on obesity. Approximately 1.5 million adults are overweight. At least 400 million adults are obese. But most importantly, let's focus on the children. 20 million children under the age of 5 are overweight. And again, just you can Google this very quickly to at least remind ourselves of the definition of obese and overweight. It is simply using the BMI, body mass index, as an indicator. 25 to 30, overweight. More than 30, obese. So this is something that we need to keep in mind. I was just looking at the internet yesterday, and there's a report, I wish I copied it, there's a report that came out, day before yesterday. I was flying yesterday, at least I came in yesterday. And the report on obesity in America has actually worsened. This is a report 2 days ago showing that now over 30 states are having 30% of their population obese. And this is compared with several years ago when the average obesity rate was 15%. So again, we're dealing with a problem that is on the rise. Now let's focus for a moment on type 2 diabetes. 90 to 95% of all cases of diabetes is actually type 2. And again, for those of you who may not be medical, just remember the easy way to remember type 1 disease is basically when you produce no insulin, because there's destruction or disruption of the pancreatic beta cells that produce insulin. Am I okay in the back with my speed? Okay. So that's type 1 disease. Type 2 diabetes is diabetes where there's either insufficient amount of insulin being produced or the tissues are being partially non-responsive to the available insulin, either or both. So type 2 diabetes typically rises as obesity increases. And you can see 90 to 95% of all diabetes is really type 2. and they're often diagnosed several years after the onset of complications. In the past, type 2 diabetes presented itself primarily in people over 40 or 50, and sometimes much later. Type 2 diabetes now can be presented, can present itself in the child or the adolescent. So there clearly is a change in presentation. Now, when one looks at the prevalence of diabetes worldwide, you'll see there are about 170 million people worldwide with diabetes. Approximately 3 million people die each year worldwide from the complications of diabetes. And again, most of the diabetic cases are type 2. Worldwide, it's not getting any better. It is projected that by 2030, the incidence of diabetes worldwide will double. It is particularly rampant throughout the Americas, South America, North America, Central America. But I'll show you some data in a moment regarding the trends in both obesity and diabetes that is projected beyond today. Well, here we go, in fact. It's right here. You'll see, for example, in the United States and Canada, it is projected that by 2030, there'll be a 72% increase. Now, let's look at Latin America. There's 148%. You can't see from the back very well, so I'm going to read it to you. A 148% increase. In Europe, a 32% increase. Now, in certain parts of Asia, diabetes is actually quite uncommon. Several years ago, I was going to Japan to give a talk, and they said, well, don't even talk about diabetes because it's not very common here. Well, you'll see that it'll be 100% increase in China, 150% increase in India, 161% increase in Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth. So the trend is not, there isn't a geographic a selection. Every region will be affected by this increase. Now, again, this is not inconsequential economically, particularly in these times. In 2007, the world spent over $232 billion, to treat and prevent diabetes and its complications. In the United States alone, it was over $174 billion for the care, both direct medical expense and indirect care as well.
We are really in the midst of a dual epidemic. Experts call it diabesity. Over the past decade, childhood cases of type 2 diabetes have increased tenfold because of rising rates of obesity. Commonly called adult onset diabetes, children as young as 8 years old are being diagnosed with the disease.
If we don't get a handle on this, what's going to happen is that we're going to get kids developing illnesses at a very early age. And some of these illnesses can actually kill them.
Okay. The point here is to show there is clearly attention, international attention, relative to this growing problem. Now, the consequence of diabetes is not only focusing on the adult, the adolescent, the child, but even the unborn is being affected by diabetes. Diabetes can have a pre-gestation or preconceptional effect. Let's define these terms for a moment. The term pre-gestational diabetes is really diabetes that predates pregnancy. It's occurring before pregnancy. It can cause serious impact on the developing fetus, such as birth defects, a term we'll refer to as diabetic embryopathy. The embryo undergoes various types of malformations. Diabetes that occurs during pregnancy is called gestational diabetes, and that is the one typically that occurs later in the pregnancy and therefore affect problems such as growth and development, but not the birth formation. So just file those two to definition for a moment. With regard to diabetic embryopathy, for example, there are about in the general population about 2 to 2.5% of all normal pregnancies, normally conceived pregnancies, will have a birth defect. That's the background rate. among the diabetic population, about 6 to 10% of the diabetic offspring will have a malformation or birth defects relating to the mother having diabetes. So we can see is anywhere from a 2 to 5-fold increase incidence of birth defects among the diabetic offspring compared to the non-diabetic. In the United States, for example, 4 out of 10 babies with a heart defect will die. 1 out of 10 babies with a spinal defect, a neural tube defect, sometimes referred to as spina bifida, will die. These are some examples of a spina bifida called a lumbar sacral defect. This is an example where, in fact, the entire spinal cord or spinal column from the cranial portion all the way down to the sacral could be completely open like a fillet, a term refers to as rachischisis. What is more important is the fact that by next year, 2010, there'll be 8,000 babies, again in the United States, projected to be born with a birth defect relating to a mother who has diabetes. So again, it is a raging problem that is affecting significant populations. The problem why it is so severe in the infant is the fact that it has generational impact. It has significant economic impact. And in fact, one needs to understand what's really happening. The types of defects can be central nervous system, brain type, or it could be cardiovascular system. Now, you'll see that there's a very high incidence of cardiac defects in the mother who has in the fetus whose mother is diabetic compared to the non-diabetic. There are several others too, but they're less common, and I won't focus on those. I'll focus primarily on the central nervous system type and the cardiovascular type because they're the most severe. They're the most disabling, and in fact can be associated with deaths. Now, I want to just digress for a moment. Dr. Landless mentioned my own interest has been in diabetes. I run a research laboratory that has been interested for years in trying to understand the biology. Why diabetic women produced more malformed infants than anyone else? Why? How this occurs? And could we do something to prevent it? What can we do? So this is sharing with you briefly that what we do know is the following. I'm checking my seat. I'm going too fast. Am I okay? Okay. So what we do know is the fact that when we measure blood glucose control by a particular enzyme assay called a hemoglobin A1C, for example, in the first trimester, we find that when it's normal, less than 6%, the malformation rate is in the background rate, 3%. But as the hemoglobin A1C, as the evidence of glucose control worsens, 9, 12, 15, we see the malformation rate start worsening, 3%, 5%, 4%, 38%, 40%. So we clearly see an association between poor glucose control, and a high rate of malformation. And the question is why? Again, for years we've tried to understand that. We have a hypothesis, and we have proven much of these various steps. But without going into great detail, I'll just give you the bottom line, because I'm trying to make a point. What we have hypothesized, and in fact proven, is that diabetes, when poorly controlled, results in hyperglycemia. Hyperglycemia is a teratogen. It causes direct tissue injury, and we've proven that. We can't assume that, and this is proof that it also causes increase in what's called free radicals or reactive oxygen species. These free radicals cause cells to die prematurely in a programmed way called apoptosis. These programmed cell death result in tissue injury and prevents organs from forming. Now, it's not as simple as that, but that is the simplest way I can present it. There are several pathways that we will not get into, several biochemical pathways that actually lead to this yellow central unifying theory. there is also, in addition, there are natural antioxidants that we have in our bodies, naturally, that will clear excess free radicals. What we find is under conditions of hyperglycemia, these natural antioxidant scavenging agents are depressed. So our natural cleaners are less, but there's an increased presence of these free radicals that cause injury. Suffice it to say, we've proven all these steps, these biochemical steps, and we can basically produce malformations at will. We can produce them, we can modify them, we can manipulate all these pathways at will. And just to briefly share with you, we have a research lab. We use rodents, rats and mice, and we create diabetes, for example, by destroying their pancreatic beta cells with an agent called streptozotocin. And we also inject saline in another group just to make sure we have a proper control. We then place an insulin pellet in these animals so we can normalize their glucose. And under conditions of normal glucose conditions, we will mate them and produce pregnant animals. One with diabetes, but well-controlled, one without diabetes. And at the appropriate time, we'll allow them to develop, remove the pellet, the insulin, so they can grow under severe hyperglycemic conditions, like a diabetic mother would. And then we remove the embryos at a certain period of time and study the embryos more carefully. This is what we have found. Here's the bottom line. The last experimental slides, for those of you who are falling asleep, this is the last one of the experiment. But I think it makes a point. The point here is that here is a hypothesis that hyperglycemia produces lots of free radicals. Lots of free radicals cause excess premature programmed cell death, cell injury, and thereby causing malformations. We've shown that the pathway is multifactorial, and all of these are biochemical pathways. The purpose of showing you all of that is indeed the fact that we have now identified different targets for intervention. We can use vitamin C, vitamin E, arachidonic acid, that's fish oil or corn oil or safflower oil or even primrose oil, or vitamin E, or lipoic acid or folic acid. All these are targets. So we now know what the target areas are. And the good news, I don't have the slide to show you, I promise you it was the last experimental slide. We've then fed rats those various nutrients and have been able to reduce the birth defects. So we're in the process right now, in fact, of conducting clinical trials where we can actually implement or use some of those nutritional agents. So we at least have some understanding of the biology of what happens in embryonic defect or diabetic embryopathy. We then have some hope that by using these nutritional supplements based on target sites, we can alter the outcome. How about the rest of the population with diabetes? Well, I want to share with you that which I think most of you may know. But just to remind you, I think the very nice studies done at Loma Linda conducted three large longitudinal studies, again, focusing on diet and lifestyle questionnaires, one in 1958 to 1996, one in 1976 to 1988. But again, you can see that when these studies, looking at these questionnaires among 23,000 Adventists, they showed, again, prolonged longevity among those who practice a certain lifestyle habit versus those who don't, lowering off many diseases. The subsequent study used 34,000, aged 30 years and older, and found who adopted components of the so-called Adventist lifestyle was in fact protective against certain diseases. Longevity, but you see that there's also increased lifespan to 10 years. But it's not, lifespan projection is not enough. Quality of life is really what's important. But I think the study also showed quality of life is in fact realized. I want to start by saying the study also showed that increased meat resulted in an increased cancer rate. And you recall that I did show in fact that we're among the lifestyle-induced diseases were cancer rates. It also showed again that legumes were protective against the same cancers that, in fact, meat was actually not protective against. The risk of heart attacks was reduced by 50% from eating nuts several times a week. The heart attack risk reduced by 45% from related or associated with whole wheat bread. Drinking 5 or more glasses was associated with a reduction in heart disease. Prostate cancer was reduced by 40% associated with tomato consumption. Soy milk usage was associated with a reduced in prostate cancer risk. Again, this study very nicely showed certain associations with certain reductions with lifestyle effects. And many of you know the most recent study, which is ongoing, is 2002 to 2012, attempts to look at diversity. Looks at diversity in geography, in ethnicity, in age, to see if similar findings can be replicated. They'll be focusing throughout the United States and Canada, and will continue to explore the same links, but a more diverse population, focusing on the role of these in the outcomes. I want to share with you a Finnish study. The Finnish Diabetes Prevention Study also used lifestyle intervention and outcome. And there are several others, but I picked only one. Because the question always is the Adventist Health Studies sufficient? And in science, we like to say we need 3 points to draw a straight line. The first point, the first finding, is a point you file. You want another study to replicate it. The second time it's replicated, it is nice confirmation, but you really would love a third one. So I'm going to give you the second one here, and we'll allow for homework. You'll find the third one in the literature. It does exist, but I didn't have the time to present it. But the Finnish study used lifestyle intervention and with 3-year results. And they basically, the goal was lifestyle intervention, changes in diet and exercise behavior. The design included 522 middle-aged overweight subjects who were randomized. They had impaired glucose tolerance, and they were randomized to an lifestyle intervention versus usual behavior. And the goal of the intervention really was to reduce body weight, to reduce fat intake, to increase physical activity, and increase fiber intake. What they found the results were as follows. Significant improvement in each interventional goal. There was indeed weight reduction in the range of 3.5 to 4.5 kilograms in the intervention group, as opposed to 1 or a little less than 1 in the control group. They found also an improvement in glucose concentration and also improvement in the lipid index. Their conclusion from that study was that lifestyle changes produce beneficial effects relative to diet, physical activity, biochemical markers, as well as reduced diabetes risk. So again, a Finnish study very nicely corroborating or supporting the Adventist Health Studies. And again, as I said, there are other studies that do corroborate the fact that lifestyle intervention can be preventive as well as corrective. So in summary, today, lifestyle is indeed becoming tomorrow's epidemic. And I hope I shared that with you, or at least I convinced you, that we've simply switched from dying from communicable diseases to dying from diseases of our own doing. And type 2 diabetes is certainly a lifestyle disease that affects approximately 170 million people worldwide and is greatly impacted by the growing epidemic in obesity. I shared with you also the fact that lifestyle intervention or modification in lifestyle can prevent certain diseases such as diabetes in high-risk individuals and can also obviate, that's an incorrectly spelled word, obviate the need for drug therapy. Vegetarian diet or, again, diet with certain nutrients contained can have a significant reduction in the risk of obesity, diabetes, or other diseases. I also shared with you the impact of diabetes not only on adults and adolescents, on youngsters, but also on the unborn, creating birth defects. And shared with you the promising studies that our own laboratory has been working on to to try to understand the biology and thereby use intervention therapy to alter the outcome. And lastly, overall, I think lifestyle changes clearly has been shown to have a positive impact in preventing certain diseases and improving health, as evidenced by the Adventist Health Studies, the Finnish diabetes studies, and several others as well. So with this, I want to thank you so much for your attention.